It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
With the baseball postseason underway, I thought it would be a good time to share our conversation with Jeff Parrott, the former major league pitcher who also starred at the University of Kentucky and for Lafayette High School. Grew up right here in Lexington, spent more than 10 years in the major leagues, and obviously can share a lot of stories with us from his time in the big leagues. He also worked with me on several Lexington Legends TV broadcasts. Always a pleasure to have him with us, and he added a lot to our broadcast. Jeff Parrott with us today.
Thanks, Keith. I appreciate it. You've gotten me out of retirement, too.
Well, I'm enjoying it, and I hope you are, too. Let me go back to when things got started for you as a professional baseball player and kind of tie it into something that happened recently. University of Kentucky pitcher Zach Thompson was drafted in the first round. A lot of excitement about that, and he was certainly not the only player drafted from UK, but he was in the first round, so a lot of attention was focused on him. A lot of other guys are getting their first opportunities in professional baseball following this draft. Tell me about your draft day or draft days, as it were, and how things got started for you.
Right. Well, first of all, congratulations to Zach. Being a first-round draft choice is a big deal, especially nowadays. You're investigated inside and out. You really have to be a complete player that works really hard with great upside and great stuff. As far as my own experience, I was hoping to get drafted, you know, and heard several rumors like that. But that was 1983, and several things have changed since that point. But that's something that I feel like as an athlete everybody dreams of, having that opportunity. And I can remember as a kid growing up when I played Little League, I hoped to make a Babe Ruth team. When I made a Babe Ruth team, I hoped to make the high school team. And then I hoped to play college baseball. Then I hoped to play pro ball. So that was something that you worked for, and it was goals you set. And so it's part of the reality of the deal, and you better be thankful for it.
Mm-hmm. You told me, I think, one time that a big change for you came in high school, maybe between seasons. High school athletes, sometimes you're going to still have a growth spurt in high school. And you mentioned something about you came back the next season, the baseball felt smaller in your hand. In other words, you were able to throw it a lot harder and maybe at that point realize that you might be able to do something with this game.
Right. It was actually one game. I was pitching in a regional tournament in Martinsville, Virginia for Sonny Denniston and our old South Lexington team. Mm-hmm. And I was always a spinner. I could throw the curveball, the slider, turn it this way, turn it that way. And, you know, I threw pretty hard, but there was always guys that threw harder, you know, that were around me. And then during that tournament, the umpire threw me a ball during the game, and I felt it, and it felt like a little golf ball. It was small, mm-hmm. and it felt good, and I threw it. And when I threw it, it took off, and it kind of sailed, and it was just gas. It felt good. And I remember a bunch of guys behind the plate went, woo, and they were hooping and hollering. So from that point on, I was going to be a power pitcher.
and you knew it right then. Yeah.
Whether it worked or not.
Yeah, and of course, obviously, you got to gain command, and there's so much more to pitching. But on the other hand, it's hard to teach that kind of stuff. Either if you have that basic stuff, you had a good fastball that rises. I mean, that's a good tool to as a foundation, isn't it?
Absolutely. A lot of thankfulness for God-given talents and opportunities and this, that, and the other. And there somewhat has to be a little bit of a recklessness too, a hunger to try to get out there and try to see what you can actually do.
Mm-hmm. Now, we want to touch on your college days as well at the University of Kentucky, and that the step in between Lafayette High and the pros. How would you describe your development there?
Right. Well, it was going pretty good. There was a chance I could have got drafted out of high school. They were mm-hmm. looking at us over at Lafayette. Ended up one of my teammates, Jerry Larrison, another pitcher, got drafted that year. And some of that was because of the attention that maybe we had gathered as a team and stuff. Another one of our pitchers pitched at Morehead State, so we had a pretty good outfit that year. But the recruiting was pretty good. I remember going up, I was invited to the Cincinnati Reds pre-draft tryout in Riverfront Stadium. So you get to go into the stadium with all the prospects. There's 110, 115 guys, and you get to throw in the morning, then hopefully you get to throw in the afternoon, and in the afternoon is the game. And so I was out there on the mound, and there was guys behind the mound. There was Gene Bennett and Chet Montgomery, some of these old Reds scouts that were mm-hmm. around, and then Bud Middall was back there with them, and he was a coach at Michigan at the time. But I remember throwing a couple of pitches, and Gene Bennett walks up and says, "Son." And I was like, "Here it comes, man. He's going to talk to you about getting drafted. How would you like a college scholarship?" And I was like, "Man, I'm in a pro park trying to be pro." I said, "That'd be great."
Yeah.
And so Bud Middall happened to be on the field, and he offered me. And when that happened, a lot of people started getting more interested in stuff. But ended up always wanted to be a Wildcat. Coach Madison was an easy sell. But, man, he was young. He was 28 years old when I went over there.
Yeah, he hadn't been in the coaching ranks or head coaching ranks very long. In fact, I remember talking to him one time, you have to adjust to the coaching role because I'm sure when he was 20, he still expected to be pitching when he was 25 or so, but some arm trouble, and he had to move into the coaching role right away and obviously adjusted well to it. But at the same time, he wasn't much older than you were.
No, absolutely. It's hilarious to think of the things that we expected him to know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that there's no way.
Yeah.
And so, but he did a great job.
Yeah. Now, on from there, you got drafted out of college. And, of course, this time the time was right to turn pro, get into the pro ranks. Tell me about that day, that decision.
Right. Well, I'd been drafted the year before late, and we thought as a family that perhaps I could do just as good the next year as long as I stayed healthy. Came back to school, got a 9th-round pick, and there was no doubt that you're a senior in college that wants to play pro ball, so you're going to sign. You're hoping that they offer you something. And so they came in and they gave me $3,500 and an incentive bonus, which if you play 4 years and make it through AAA, you get another $4,000.
Wow.
So $3,500 that time, that's heck, far, that was four wheels under me. Get me places.
It would get your attention at that age, at that time. And now, you know, you're adding on several zeros to a top round draft pick there. It's amazing how the structure has changed. But at that time, that was a pretty good offer and one that I'm sure you were very excited to get.
Absolutely. They took all of the draft picks for the Milwaukee Brewers that year and put us all in Paintsville, Kentucky. That was the last year that they had a professional team in Paintsville. And we all signed, went down there for $600 a month, every one of us. And heck, there was four of us that lived in a trailer, Clyde and Sue's Trailer Park. And we paid $125 apiece to live in that thing. There was four of us.
Oh. Well, you know, that really hasn't changed a whole lot. It may not be Clyde and Sue's anymore. It may have a nice name like, Premier Oaks or something like that. But it's still the same sort of thing. A lot of ball players in a small amount of space and trying to save as much money as they can. And at the same time, eat right, keep up your nutrition and all that like they expect you to do. But it's still pretty tough on the minor league players, isn't it?
Right. I had thought that maybe they were making some decent salaries, but apparently they're really not. They get a 6-month salary, basically, and a lot of them, I guess, are making $10,000 or $12,000 a year, something like that.
And whatever, between $1,500 and $2,000 a month, you know, depending on what year in professional baseball you are. And, of course, once you get there and your season gets started, you're either at the ballpark or at your apartment for a short period of time, or you're on the bus, or you're at a hotel, or you're at another ballpark. So you don't have much, I guess cost of living isn't very high, and you don't have much of a life, but baseball is your life pretty much at that point, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, smart money tells you that whatever town you go to on the road, you know where the Sizzler is, because they've got the lunch special, the lunch buffet. And if you hit it just right after 3 o'clock, they're bringing out dinner menu items. Mm-hmm. So you get to eat the dinner menu, all you can eat. And then after the game, you hope you can find a grocery store, or not a grocery store, maybe a gas station where you can get you a carton of milk and a 6-pack of donuts to take back to last you till the next Sizzler.
Which is on every strength and conditioning coach's program now, I guess, for diet. But, yeah, one of the things that I remember when the bus would pull up, especially if it was a hotel, maybe the hotels changed from year to year, so maybe it was a different hotel first time we'd stayed at this one, and you could just see the heads turning, looking around, what's available, maybe after the ball game. If you're really lucky, someplace will be open after the ball game. But it wasn't unusual. Of course, by the time I was covering minor league baseball, the players all had phones. And so when we'd leave the ballpark after a night game, out come the phones and guys are ordering pizza to be delivered to the hotel. And so they had a few more options, but it still wasn't great. And it's still an almost unique lifestyle. It's really by itself a motivation to move on. I mean, they say if you don't like it where you are, get better. And that's part of the incentive, isn't it?
Yeah, that really is. I mean, in the big leagues, they feed you a spread after every game. I mean, it's a catered meal. So, yeah, it's a little different than a pack of crackers.
Yeah, exactly. Now, when you get started in professional baseball, of course, you're working with professionals. A minor league manager might be a young guy just getting started. Maybe he just finished his playing days, or it might be a guy who's managed in the minor leagues for 20 or 25 years. But as a young player, you got to develop relationships with all of those guys, and you might move on at any time. And maybe you got a manager with a different personality, even though the organization tries to kind of have an umbrella philosophy. Still, people are different individually. What was that like for you?
That's quite an experience. It really is. You really need to, kind of develop or take care of those relationships with every coach that you've got. These coaches are writing a report on you every day. Mm-hmm. And so a little bit of a negative relationship can reflect in those reports. And so you don't want any of that going in there. You want to make sure that, you know, you're doing what you need to do to stay positive. Even with a bad game, maybe he's doing something better for you. Now, occasionally, I've had people tell me things that I knew was not good for me, but you do them anyway.
You don't have much leverage at that point.
Right.
Do you?
You don't have much leverage. And sometimes it's just a test. And part of that test is to see how you react to things coming up in the future, you know, and they let you off the hook shortly after. But, man, it's always a game. And you know, when you talk about this professional baseball career, there's not a whole lot of difference between top college ball players, the Lexington Legends, and the major leaguers. Matter of fact, the talent's pretty much the same. It's the consistency. Occasionally you get the outstanding player that's going to stand out no matter where he is. But it's the consistency, the work ethic, and being able to fit in and be a good teammate. So, you know, and luck.
Yes, there's a lot of that too,
yes.
Isn't it?
You got to have an opening somewhere.
It's interesting that you put it in that formula, though, because it is more than just being able to go out there and show that you have baseball talent, because presumably everybody has at least some degree of that, or they wouldn't have been offered a contract or a draft position in the first place. So they're at opportunities to prove yourself, you know, in a sense, most every day, right?
Right, absolutely. And, I mean, you know, the guy that throws 98 miles an hour is going to get more chances than the guy that throws cutters on the outside at 88. It's just going to happen. But if you're a guy at those cutters on the outside at 88 and you're competing against another guy that's throwing cutters on the outside at 88, you might want to have a better relationship with your coach and you might want to be a better teammate. So that's something you have to plan for in the future.
Mm-hmm. When you say all things being equal, when you get that many ball players competing for a few spots, there might be situations where all things are equal except for the things that you described there.
Absolutely.
So you really earn your way or maybe lose a credit or two nearly every day, because one of the things they stress in baseball so much is doing the work that you need to do every day. You're not going to pitch every day, but you are going to get some work done every day. And you got to show your pitching coach that you're getting that work in and dedicating yourself to that. And when you say they write the reports every day, that is almost literally every day. It's after every game. They report to the big league club and the player development people. Somebody's hearing about how you did today every day.
Absolutely. And then, you know, just the dedication and stuff, the conditioning and the running. My favorite part of that was always being done. Mm-hmm. You know, but golly, getting motivated and just knowing, I mean, it used to irritate me a little bit. I always told everybody I wasn't a track star, but it seemed like the more I ran, the better I pitched. Mm-hmm. So therefore, it was my responsibility. I had to run a lot.
Yeah.
I didn't like it, but I did it anyway.
Yep. And made sure somebody sees you, right?
Well, not necessarily. It'll show up anyway. Yeah. It'll show up.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, the big day is when you make a major league ball club, and that's the thing that all the guys for the Legends or other low minors players are dreaming of. The numbers game is such that a lot of them will never get even to Double A or Triple A. But the guys who do make it to that level, now the hope is real. You didn't spend a very long time in the minor leagues, but it probably seemed long at times, I guess, while you're trying to make your way up. But tell me about the process of working your way up and then eventually making the big league club for the first time.
Right. I was a Rule 5 guy. So basically I started with Milwaukee, was drafted. After 3 years, if they don't put you on a certain roster, maybe the major league roster or the AAA roster, the Double A roster, then another team can draft you away from them during the winter meetings. And then they pay a certain amount of money. Well, after my third year, I went out and had a really outstanding year, my third year in Stockton, California, and had some people looking, and Milwaukee chose to protect a different guy besides me. Mm-hmm. And so when they did that, they opened me up, and Montreal Rule 5 me. So I went from A-ball to Major League spring training. And I was throwing the ball well at that time. I was bringing it pretty good, you know, and I was feeling confident and went through spring training, had a few ups and downs. I remember one day Buck Rogers came out on the mound during spring training against the Yankees, and you know, I'm just hoping to make the club. If I don't, I go back to Milwaukee. They sell me back for half the price.
Right.
And I said, Buck, I'm all right. Let me finish this. I said, I'm not tired. He goes, yeah, but the outfielders are. And took the ball from me. So anyway, he was always kind of messing with me a little bit. But we went through spring training. We went to Vancouver, Canada, and it basically came down to me and a guy named Bert Roberge.
Mm-hmm.
And Bert was a Canadian-French guy, too. And so I knew that was going to be tough. And then we were practicing in Atlanta the day before opening day. It was with all the big leaguers around. You know, we've become friends somewhat, you know, and I tried to fit in. And Jim Wolford walked up to me and said, congratulations, son, because they had just called Bert Roberge in to let him know they were sending him down and that I had made the team. And that's kind of a special moment right there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I remember the first day going out, and they actually warmed me up in about the sixth inning. And back then, they had the bullpens lined up with the dugout, similar like it is down at the Legends. And, I rung a couple straight through the dugout throwing wild pitches. Feeling good, though.
Yeah. Well, it is such a big day. I've talked to several former big leaguers and asked them about their call-ups, and the circumstances aren't always exactly the same, but they all remember when it happened, when they actually knew that they were going to the big leagues for the first time, because no matter what you're feeling about baseball when you were a kid, whether you were a big fan of the game and followed other players or not, but getting to the top, by that time you know how hard it is to get there, and it really is a memorable moment for everybody.
Right, and really, I felt like I'd made the team many times after that because I really felt like I always had to try out. And so, making it the first time. But there was many times leaving spring training when I would get on the airplane and sit down just waiting for somebody to come and get me. I'm like, really?
There always
I get
is
to go?
That paranoia that exists, isn't it?
Yeah.
I also read one time Jim Boughton in Ball 4 talked about you could tell if you were out in a restaurant and there were a bunch of ball players in there, you could tell which ones were the pitchers because they were the ones rotating their arms just to make sure it didn't hurt, you know, just to make sure everything was healthy. So there's always that element of paranoia in a ball player, unless you're the superstar, I guess, where you're worrying about whether the position is going to be there for you.
Well, and that happens. I mean, it was actually the paranoia for me was apparently going through some of our management people because one year I broke with St. Louis and they put out this big poster board with baseball cards of all the players. Mm-hmm. And so they had everybody's picture on there, even Fred Bird, except mine.
Oh, no.
And I was on the team, second year on the team. So I go up to the PR guy and I was like, Marty, what's the deal? He goes, I really didn't think you were going to make the team. I was like, well, I did.
There you are.
I still didn't get my picture on the poster.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but that wasn't long after that. I got released in about July of that year. So we tricked them a few times, by golly.
Yeah. Well, the big league lifestyle, of course, is obviously a lot different than what we just described in the minor leagues. And the difference is dramatic, I guess, long term, even though there are a lot of coaches and managers who have carved out good careers in the minor leagues a long time. There's really only one place to be in baseball, isn't there? And that's at the top, at least as far as comparing the lifestyles is concerned.
Right. Lifestyle way, you're exactly right. But, everything's so catered and manicured and made just absolutely the best it can be. But you're competing against the best that can be. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of a goal, too, to be in that situation. But when you really come down to it, it's just baseball. And so if you can relax yourself enough to just play the game that you grew up doing it, every now and then you tip your cap because somebody's better than you, and every now and then you get the better of them. So try to do it more often than not.
Right, right. You can't be tipping your hat too often. But on the other hand, as I've heard players say, it's a game of failure too. And some guys, especially as they get started in the minor leagues, they've been superstars in high school or maybe even in college. And to have to accept that once in a while, if you're a hitter, you're going to strike out three times and hit into a double play. And some guys let it get to them when those things like the first start happening.
Yes, absolutely. And you always just have to go back to fundamentals, and play it from there. But you guarantee one thing, there's 150 guys trying to take your place. I don't care who you are.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned, too, that it's always good to hear, too, that even the major league guys, I mean, it's a business. There's a lot of money involved. Sometimes some politics, as there would be in any career. But at the same time, when you're out on the field, if you're not having fun, then there's not much point to any of it. And I know that, you see displays of emotion sometimes that tell you these guys are still having fun. They are still playing baseball, and that's at the root of it.
Right, right. Yeah, and the emotion of the game, that's fine that it comes out. We don't really need to embarrass anybody in the modern way that, games are going. But, I like to see guys express themselves in a positive way. And that, sometimes it's just a release. You know, you've worked so hard for so long to throw that big pitch, to get that big out. It's cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a nice feeling.
Yeah, it's a great feeling. And, and when guys express that, we're seeing a little relaxing of the old unwritten rules of baseball and allowing a little bit more celebration, although it's still controversial at times.
Right, right. Well, I'm looking forward to the first pitcher that shoots the guy down all the way back to the dugout. You know, if they're going to flip their bat, you know, throw a few air fingers out there.
And you have to know that if you're going to flip the bat, if he gets you the next time, he may do a little Joaquin Andujar blow on the finger and whatever else the pitcher might do to dance halfway back to the dugout. It works that way too. But as long as it's not delaying the game or anything like that, and it's something that lets old guys face it, kids like that stuff.
Absolutely. And it doesn't have to always be personal. It can just be kind of fun, too. But, shooting them down and blowing the smoke off your finger, that they used to want to come hunt him. But, you know, people knew where he worked if you wanted to go see him.
That's right.
And, you know, one of the great things about talking trash in a baseball brawl is usually it's between two people and you've got like 50 trying to break it up. So you're in pretty good shape as long as you keep those guys off your neck.
I was going to ask you about the relationship between a player and an agent, and we hear about player agents all the time, and of course usually those relationships are first made maybe at the very beginning of your pro career in the minor leagues, but you connected with Scott Boras, who has gone on to become probably the best known player agent in baseball. How did that come about, and how did that relationship work for you?
All right, well, one of the things that agents need to do, they need to be their own talent scouts. They have to go out and find these players that they can represent that will actually make it someday. It's not like you just call enough guys and hope to represent. You actually want to represent the right ones. And one of the great things Scott Boras has always done was to do that. So most of these guys are picked up before they go to college. The Under Armour, All-America game, stuff like that. They're already involved with agencies or they kind of know which way. I had nobody going in. After my third year of pro ball, I was had a big year in the Cal League. I was voted league top prospect. Agents started calling. And so, you know, I'd considered a few things, and then I was a Rule 5 guy. Now I'm thinking, well, maybe I do need somebody to represent me. So we called some of them in. I had meetings, and I called Scott Boras. He was working out of Chicago at the time. And I said, you know, I'm interested in signing with you, Scott. What do you think? So he got on a plane and flew down and met with me and Mom and Dad and hooked us up, showed us all his stuff. And, I mean, you know, the guy could sell ice machines to Eskimos, you know. So he's pretty sharp on that. But when Scott Boras walks in the room, he's usually the smartest guy in the room. I mean, you know, he's at least tied. He knows what's going on. So that's the way that came about. He had recruited me, and I was one of his first about 30 players or so. And it was very good. Now he's, golly. But he's so innovative and knowledgeable. And although some teams may blackball you somewhat because of him, other teams will do favors because of him, because they want to have a good relationship with him. But really, just an outstanding guy, and still sends me a Christmas gift every year.
Is that right?
Yeah. With my pitiful salaries.
Well, he remembers who got him started, though. So, the relationship, I guess, varies among players. Some players would probably want to stay in very close contact with the agent. Other guys they trust the agent. They might have a different relationship, or they're glad that somebody else is handling most of that stuff. What was it like for you?
Right. I recognized his talent as far as what Scott did, you know, and his ability to do it. He played professional baseball. He played up through AA and then got his law degree while he was playing baseball. So, you know, he had an understanding for that sort of thing. So basically he would keep me informed of what's going on. I remember one time, my first year, I was arbitration eligible, and I had come off a couple of pretty good years. So that's after 3 years in the major leagues. You get to go get heard in front of a impartial juror, supposedly, to decide your final salary. It was between me and the Phillies, so I had to fly myself, Scott Boras, and another guy to New York, and we stayed at Scott's choice of his hotel. And we stayed at a very nice place. We went all the way up there, met at MLB Players Union at their offices, and everybody sat down at the table getting ready to get started, and they're getting ready to shoot me down because that's what they do. And Scott looked over at the vice president for the Phillies. They went outside, and they made an agreement. So anyway, so I got to pay for everybody's 3-day vacation. And then, but it was a good settlement. So it was cool. It
worked well in the long
term. Right. But that guy, he's just so smart. Now I saw where he sent a guy to Japan instead of having to go through the minor leagues. He's going to go over there and make $7 million and then come back as a complete free agent. Yeah. And then I can't remember what else he did the other day. He's talking about, I guess, making everybody a free agent, doing away with the draft.
Well, if they're radical, innovative ideas, you would expect that he might be a good source of those ideas, always thinking ahead and trying to develop whatever's next, be looking forward to whatever's next.
Right. Well, He's the one that can tell these organizations actually how much they're worth, how much they can make by signing certain players, and how much they're hiding and how much they're trying to use a salary cap, and he does not like the concept of a salary cap.
No, I would think not. I would think not. I wanted to touch on the on-field part of the lifestyle of a Major League Baseball player, and the agent information is very, very interesting, and it's great to get that perspective. But you had a very solid career. One thing in my years in minor league baseball that I learned to respect was if you can get to the big leagues and stay there, there's no such thing as someone having a subpar major league career. Not that you did. You had a very solid major league career. But when I hear about a guy who played 7 or 8 years in the major leagues and people say, oh, well, he wasn't very good. Well, he was in the major leagues for 7 or 8 years. You're at the top and at that level, and it's very meaningful. And I would think that as you've looked back on your playing days, you probably would appreciate that more as time goes by.
Right. Well, you know, when you look back on it, I guess a lot of it's like anything. The memories aren't always the best because when things went wrong, it felt like that was something you could have controlled. You could have made it better. And when things went right, well, that's the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
So you have a tendency to focus back on the things that went wrong more because that's what you were trying to fix all the time. Mm-hmm. And instead of just going, straight through and just enjoy it all the time. But in my personal career, I had 3 really good years. I mean, top of the league years that probably earned me 8. Mm-hmm. But that's the thing. You have to earn your days.
Right.
And
right.
There's no gifts.
Yeah, well, you had the 1 year I know that you were 12-4. That's all-star credentials right there as far as won and loss record. And, again, it was a solid performance that, as you say, no doubt bought you extra looks on down the line too, and so you kind of earn that, and you got to get to the top, and staying at the top is really, really difficult. But you did that for over a decade.
Well, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, you can have regrets, but I don't. There's so many other things that could have happened, could have went right or wrong. But yeah, I would have liked for it to have been better, but we've made a pretty good career out of it, and yeah, it can't be taken away.
Absolutely. Well, tell me about maybe a highlight on the field at the major league level. Anything that particularly stands out, any story that you really kind of comes to the top of your mind when you think about success stories in the big league?
Well, when you think about success stories, see, this is another one of those situations when a great success that I had one time in St. Louis, I brought 54,000 people to their feet. And I did that. We were the visiting team. And they were getting ready to clinch the division. Mm-hmm. And Danny Cox puts down a bunt and first and second. And I wheel around and Tim Wallach's backpedaling to the base. He's in the wrong spot. So I double pumped and threw it all the way into left field. And so 2 runs scored and 54,000 people went crazy. So that was one of that's one of those moments that you remember, but it didn't go exactly like
that.
You
don't forget that sound.
Yeah, but, there's lots of fun things. One, when you're going well, I remember one day just before the All-Star break, it was in, I guess, 88. We were playing in Atlanta, and they weren't very good at the time. Mm-hmm. But still, they had us tied. It was the 13th inning, and we went in. We scored a run, and I was the pitcher of record. So I go out and immediately give up a leadoff triple. It's like 105 degrees, and people got planes to catch it. Mm-hmm. And so I got lucky. I went out, strike out, ground out, and everybody got happy. So that was a big moment to make all your – that actually made the team happy that we got to go home then because they had their flights to catch. But, all of it. I mean, you have flashbacks, memories, things trigger certain ideas. But, the first time you pitched and I remember the last time I pitched, I did it about 80 times.
About the teammates, I mean, you met hundreds of them over the years, both at the minor and the major league. But as far as the major league level and people that that fans would know, was there anybody who everyone knew was a talented player, but you found him to be a great teammate as well, just the kind of guy that you would like to be around, even if he were not the big star?
Right. You know, amazingly, Keith, and I'm sure that you've seen this too, but the guys that seem like are at the top of the game are almost all of them are really well-rounded individuals. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're friendly, respectful, intelligent, successful, humble, and these guys, they kind of act that way. And I was fortunate with playing with so many different teams is there's a lot of Hall of Famers I got to play with. Andre Dawson, Eck, with Oakland, and Ricky Henderson, and just so many different guys that I had a great relationship with all of them. Goose Gossage, he was outstanding. He was my locker mate in Oakland, and is one of the all-time greats. And I think certainly when those guys are that good and you recognize that they're that good, you kind of have a certain respect for them, and they respect you for doing that. Not you're trying to take that away from them. But I like to learn from those guys and always asking questions. Heck, I took stolen base lessons from Ricky Henderson one day. Took shortstop lessons from Ozzie Smith because I wanted to see how he did it. So why not ask those guys?
Sure. They'll find out how they go about their work.
I haven't been able to teach any of my kids how to be Ozzie Smith yet, but we're working on it.
Well, speaking of teaching kids, I wanted to come back to that before we go today. And we want to congratulate the Tate's Creek High School baseball program on their recent state championship. First time for the 11th region since the Woodford County team did it back in 2012, right? And
yes.
You were the coach. That must have been quite a thrill. Long after your major league playing days are over, to come back as a coach and coach a team to a state championship.
Absolutely. Congratulations to Coach Pointer, Tate Creek Commodores. Yeah. Heck, I remember when they were really good back in the 70s, too. Mm-hmm. I was competing against those guys. They were into the finals like 3 years in a row and won it twice. Tony Mack.
Yes.
Uh-huh. There's a name. But, yeah, I know how good that feels. That's outstanding. That's so much work, so much effort. Also, congratulations to Mark Blythe, former UK player. His son was the leadoff hitter for the Tate Creek team, and I know that he spent a lot of days on the road teaching those young men, too. He's an outstanding coach, worked with KBC and this, that, and the other. But I know how good that feels, and to be the last one standing, it's unbelievable. It really
yeah.
is.
Yeah, the degree of difficulty there. You're facing basically everybody in the state wants that title when the season starts, and you're able to win some big games and come down to the last one and capture that state championship, and I'm sure that's among your great baseball memories, even including the Major League days.
Absolutely. That was so much fun to watch those young men go out and perform. And that's one of the things that I know. If you want to be a good coach, get good players. Right. We had good players.
Right. You get smarter immediately, don't you?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, it's been great talking with you today. And there are other topics about baseball that we could discuss and go on and on. But we'll end there for today. You can maybe fill us in on what's keeping you busy these days.
Thanks. I appreciate it. My only remedy to slow play of baseball is cheaper beer.
Cheaper beer.
There you
All
go.
Right. That'll do it. That'll do it. They won't care then, right?
That's
yeah,
right.
They won't care. But anyway, we appreciate your being here today and getting our podcast off to a great start. It's always good to talk with you. And again, appreciated working with you on those Legends games. And we always had a lot of fun doing that. And if we got some good baseball information in there, well, that was a bonus, too. But I appreciate your analysis and sharing your thoughts with us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure. We got to see some good players over at the Legends. And good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to The Sports Page with Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to The Sports Page through Google Play or at our website, wuky.org.